Test 3, Part 2. Now turn to Part 2. You will hear Keith Randall, the founder of the Access to History series, demonstrating that there is virtually no occasion in life when the study of history is irrelevant. For questions 7 to 14, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds to look at Part 2.
For a fortnight recently, I lay paralysed from the neck downwards in a hospital bed, not knowing whether I would live or die. The plan was that my wife would stay with me all the time and would look after my body from the outside, checking what was put into it and taken out of it and why, while I would concentrate on fighting from the inside. Very soon, I was spending several hours every day enjoying going over my favourite stories from the history I had studied for most of my life. Where I knew relatively little about the events concerned, I merely took pleasure from recounting what I remembered, in the same way as you would with a work of fiction. But where the topic was one I had studied in depth, I could enjoy the added dimensions of thinking about how historians had reached very different conclusions about what had happened and why, and how these differences often reflected the values and attitudes of the period in which the author had been writing. For a long time, I have been aware that, for me, there have been two great benefits gained from studying history. There has been the pleasure of finding out about much of what had happened in the past, and there has been the acquisition of patterns of thought, which I have used when tackling most practical problems in both my personal and my working life. It is the patterns of thought point which has kept me arguing that there is no more worthwhile subject than history to study. As the days passed, I enjoyed playing a type of fly-on-the-wall game. Although I was lying flat and I couldn't see what was happening, I could hear everything that went on. I was amazed by just how many differences there seemed to be. Most noticeably, they never quite managed to identify exactly what it was they were attempting to achieve. As a result, they normally ended up either making no decision at all or choosing a course of action which was likely to move them forwards very little. If I had been teaching them history, I would have been saying, read the question carefully and work out exactly what you are being asked to do. Otherwise, you will end up going round and round in circles and finishing up getting nowhere in particular. It would be one of those classic cases where a student writes all he knows about Charles I merely because he saw his name in the question, instead of discussing how far he was responsible for the outbreak of the Civil War, as he was actually asked to do. For several days, the conversation around one bed was all about a neighbour, while attempting to manoeuvre his car, had accidentally reversed into my fellow patient's garden wall, partly demolishing it. It seemed that, at the time, the person driving the car had been in a very emotional state, having just had an explosive row with his wife. I heard several times about how stupid the man was and how he must not only be made to pay for the damages done, but must also be made to undertake all the necessary arrangements with whoever was going to do the work. At no time was any mention made of the thoughts or feelings of the neighbour. It was as if he had suddenly been turned into the enemy. I tried to imagine what would have been said had the conversation taken place with my family around my bed. I guessed that the annoyance and the determination to make the neighbour pay for the damage would have been the same, but was sure there would have been an additional dimension to the discussion. There would have been thoughts exchanged about what the car driver might have been feeling and, in all probability, there would have been a consideration of how we could get the outcome we wanted while causing our neighbour as little distress as possible. In other words, we would have been at pains to look at the situation from his point of view. No doubt you are already ahead of me in working out where my thoughts are going. Those who study history for any length of time, and who get into the habit of thinking historically, almost automatically consider both sides of an issue whenever they are forming an opinion or deciding on a course of action. On the one hand, this, on the other hand, that, is a routine part of the mental process. That is why historians are often accused of sitting on the fence, of being too willing to see the opposite point of view. What would it look like from here? What would it look like from there? Is a standard way of tackling a question in history. Life would be very straightforward if issues were considered from only one point of view. Praise or blame could be apportioned very simply, presumably from the point of view of the person making the judgment. Yet most historians would feel very uncomfortable thinking in this way. When I heard someone say in considerable exasperation, "The trouble with historians is that they're too reasonable," I knew exactly what was meant, but I regarded the comment as one of praise rather than of criticism, as was intended.
Now you will hear part two again.
For a fortnight recently, I lay paralysed from the neck downwards in a hospital bed, not knowing whether I would live or die. The plan was that my wife would stay with me all the time and would look after my body from the outside, checking what was put into it and taken out of it and why, while I would concentrate on fighting from the inside. Very soon, I was spending several hours every day enjoying going over my favourite stories from the history I had studied for most of my life. Where I knew relatively little about the events concerned, I merely took pleasure from recounting what I remembered, in the same way as you would with a work of fiction. But where the topic was one I had studied in depth, I could enjoy the added dimensions of thinking about how historians had reached very different conclusions about what had happened and why, and how these differences often reflected the values and attitudes of the period in which the author had been writing. For a long time, I have been aware that, for me, there have been two great benefits gained from studying history. There has been the pleasure of finding out about much of what had happened in the past, and there has been the acquisition of patterns of thought, which I have used when tackling most practical problems in both my personal and my working life. It is the patterns of thought point which has kept me arguing that there is no more worthwhile subject than history to study. As the days passed, I enjoyed playing a type of fly-on-the-wall game. Although I was lying flat and I couldn't see what was happening, I could hear everything that went on. I was amazed by just how many differences there seemed to be. Most noticeably, they never quite managed to identify exactly what it was they were attempting to achieve. As a result, they normally ended up either making no decision at all or choosing a course of action which was likely to move them forwards very little. If I had been teaching them history, I would have been saying, "Read the question carefully and work out exactly what you are being asked to do. Otherwise, you will end up going round and round in circles and finishing up getting nowhere in particular." It would be one of those classic cases where a student writes all he knows about Charles I merely because he saw his name in the question, instead of discussing how far he was responsible for the outbreak of the Civil War, as he was actually asked to do. For several days, the conversation around one bed was all about a neighbour, while attempting to manoeuvre his car, had accidentally reversed into my fellow patient's garden wall, partly demolishing it. It seemed that, at the time, the person driving the car had been in a very emotional state, having just had an explosive row with his wife. I heard several times about how stupid the man was and how he must not only be made to pay for the damages done, but must also be made to undertake all the necessary arrangements with whoever was going to do the work. At no time was any mention made of the thoughts or feelings of the neighbour. It was as if he had suddenly been turned into the enemy. I tried to imagine what would have been said had the conversation taken place with my family around my bed. I guessed that the annoyance and the determination to make the neighbour pay for the damage would have been the same, but was sure there would have been an additional dimension to the discussion. There would have been thoughts exchanged about what the car driver might have been feeling and, in all probability, there would have been a consideration of how we could get the outcome we wanted while causing our neighbour as little distress as possible. In other words, we would have been at pains to look at the situation from his point of view. No doubt you are already ahead of me in working out where my thoughts are going. Those who study history for any length of time, and who get into the habit of thinking historically, almost automatically consider both sides of an issue whenever they are forming an opinion or deciding on a course of action. On the one hand, this, on the other hand, that, is a routine part of the mental process. That is why historians are often accused of sitting on the fence, of being too willing to see the opposite point of view. What would it look like from here? What would it look like from there? Is a standard way of tackling a question in history. Life would be very straightforward if issues were considered from only one point of view. Praise or blame could be apportioned very simply, presumably from the point of view of the person making the judgment. Yet most historians would feel very uncomfortable thinking in this way. When I heard someone say in considerable exasperation, "The trouble with historians is that they're too reasonable," I knew exactly what was meant, but I regarded the comment as one of praise rather than of criticism, as was intended.
That's the end of part 2.